On the first day of the Battle of the Somme, the 1st of July 1916, the Tyneside Irish and the Tyneside Scottish, when their whistles blew, left their trenches and walked slowly towards the German guns. There was a brigade chaplain, a Father George McBertie, and he was wounded in the conflict. But later on he went back to the battlefields and he found and retrieved a set of Irish war pipes from the battlefield. And one of the pipers that day later said that he chose to play the minstrel boy because it seemed to him the words were most appropriate at the time. And those words you've just listened to at the start of this podcast, which is all about the Tyneside Irish, and in particular, the 27th Battalion of the Tyneside Irish that went over the top on that sunny summer's day 106 years ago. The reason that I've chosen to feature this battalion this week is because just a few weeks ago now, we followed in the footsteps of one of the captains, one of the officers that went into battle that day. And he was a captain who later became a major, James Bibby, from the 27th or the 4th Battalion of the Tyneside Irish. And we feature his story because the family that I took to the battlefields and followed in his footsteps on that day all the way to Shelter Wood on the Somme was the great-grandsons and the great-great-grandsons of that particular officer. And they've wanted for many years to go to the battlefields to see where Bibby fought and where he was actually wounded in the hand. So that's what we did. Now, the two lads that we took, they were in their early 40s and they were cousins, and they were accompanied by, one of them had a 14-year-old boy, and then we've got two young lads that were 9 and 11. And they're going to feature in the second part of this podcast. Rather than me explaining what they found on the battlefields, they're going to do it. But before we do that, I suppose we ought to have a close look at what actually happened to Bibby and those Tyneside men on that day. Now, in the 1911 census, James Bibby was 23 years old and he was living in Newcastle with his parents and siblings. And at that stage, he was working in the insurance industry as a clerk. In September 1914, just a few weeks after war had been declared, he enlisted with the Northern Cyclist Battalion, and his attestation form shows that he'd previously served in the Royal Engineers for over 4 years. In May of 1915, he applied for a commission, and in September 1915, before he travelled to the Western Front, after he was commissioned into the 27th Battalion of the Northumberland Fusiliers, he married a lady called Edith. And we've got a newspaper report on that wedding. It says that the marriage of Captain J. Victor Bibby to Miss Edith Smith was solemnised yesterday afternoon in St. Mary's Parish Church, Newcastle. The bride was gowned in white satin and wore a veil and orange blossom. Miss Bibby's dress was of turquoise blue, and she also wore a brown velvet hat. And the bridesmaid was attired in a turquoise gown and also wore a brown velvet hat. The best man was Second Lieutenant Bonner, and Mr. Ashdall Dick acted as the groomsman. A reception followed the marriage at the Masonic Hall in Maple Street, and the honeymoon will be spent in the South, and a large number of presents were received. And then, just a few months later, on the 4th of January 1916, James proceeded to France, to the Western Front, with his battalion. Now, we know exactly what happened to his battalion on the 1st of July because the entry in the battalion diary was actually signed off by James himself. And it says that the hour attack was 7:30 a.m. The battalion, in column of platoons, was in position at 150 paces distance, and the left of the brigade became under heavy machine gun and barrage fire right from the start. The 27th Battalion on the right suffered a few casualties when they were crossing the Shape Spur, when heavy machine gun fire caused numbers to drop. They, however, continued to press on although the left battalions were held up and about 70% dropped before they reached the German front line. The trench was in the hands of the Germans, as the Royal Scots had not left sufficient men to mop up the garrison. The 27th Battalion crossed this trench and some managed to reach Contlemason, but had to retire to join the survivors of rear companies that were under Captain James Bibby, who at 10 a.m. were holding Shelter Wood. These in turn retired slowly before the Germans and eventually joined up with the Royal Scots that were holding German support and the second support lines. There they remained continuously attacking and attacked until relieved on the early morning of the 4th of July, their total casualties being officers 5 killed and 15 wounded, including Bibby himself, other ranks 99 killed, 16 died of wounds, 373 wounded, and 58 men were missing. Now, we also know from newspaper records and from his own file that Bibby was awarded the Distinguished Service Order for his efforts on that day. And there was a Lieutenant Dan O'Halen, and he wrote to Bibby's wife, explaining to her that he gained the DSO, and says it was thoroughly deserved. It seems that the gallant captain collected organised men of several units and forced flank guard to the division on the right. They formed a defensive line in the second German trench and held that position for 3 days and two nights. The letter goes on to say, "You have reason to be proud of your husband's efforts." We know then that Bibby came home, because there's another newspaper report to say that he'd been wounded on the 1st of July, and that he was enjoying a few days leave in Newcastle, and that he's been awarded the DSO for conspicuous gallantry. Now, James did eventually return to his battalion, and he was wounded again in Arras in 1917. Not in action in this case. They were parading on a Sunday morning, and a German shell entered the courtyard where they paraded, and there were several killed and wounded, and he was one of them that was wounded. He was eventually discharged in 1919, and in 1939 on the register, him and Edith were living in Sheffield, and once again he'd returned to the insurance industry, and James died in 1967. So to find out a little bit more about those Tyneside Irish, the 27th Northumberland Fusiliers, or the 4th Tyneside Irish, I sought the help of a man called Martin Talbot, who I met at number 56 Bed and Breakfast on the Somme a few weeks ago by sheer coincidence. It was the same trip that we were guiding Bibby's family on when we arrived at number 56 in the evening. There was Martin, and he had with him a brochure of the Tyneside Irish Brigade Memories Project had produced. Martin was one of the people that put together this brochure, so I invited him along to the podcast, and he gave us some details, more information about that famous battalion, that famous regiment that went over the top and suffered so many casualties on the first day of the Somme. So how did you get interested in all this then, in the Great War, and the Tyneside Irish in particular?
Well, the Great War has been something which I've been interested in for a very long time now. I'm in my 30s, and I've had a history background. I studied history at university. And when I finished university, I went back to the northeast of England near Newcastle, and I got involved in leading tours around Newcastle, not necessarily related to the Great War. And obviously with that came the Northumberland Fusiliers. I became a member of the Western Front Association, and in my spare time, it's all about listening to podcasts and reading about aspects of the Great War. It really does take over your life. And then I discovered John Sheen, who's a local author, wrote a book about the Tyneside Irish, and yeah, he co-authored a book about the Tyneside Scottish. So I try to incorporate some of those into my tours.
So you haven't got a family connection then yourself? You haven't got an ancestor that served?
No, I've got one ancestor who served, who was killed in the First World War, but nothing to do with the Northumberland Fusiliers.
Right.
Purely research for tours. But you find, when you find the stories out about them, that you become very much connected to those individuals.
Yeah, they become part of your family, really, don't they?
and surprisingly, this year was the first year that I'd actually gone over to the Somme area. I'd been to France before, And I stayed at number 56 with Julian David, who've been featured on your podcast previously.
Yeah.
And really, I feel as though I can't leave the First World War alone. I mean, in terms of the things I do with my projects, I lead tours around war memorials. And this week, I've just been talking to a group of UOTCs who were formed in 1908 after the Haldane reforms.
What does that stand for, that abbreviation?
University Officer Training Corps.
Yeah.
So the Officer Training Corps in 1908, there was the senior division and the junior division, and many of these men went on to become officers in the British Army during the First World
Reform.
War. Today, it's still going strong. They're army reservists, and many of them become reservist officers, and some of them go on to become full-time officers as well. And then, after that point, just in the last year, I became involved in the Tyneside Irish Project,
Yeah.
where we researched various soldiers who'd been involved in the Tyneside Irish. We created an exhibition, and we went around Newcastle, Seaham, Cleethomore in the northwest of England. Tyneside Irish were recruiting out the northwest of England, you
That's
know.
what I was, that
And
was going to be my next question is who were, I mean, we're particularly interested in the 27th Battalion of the Northumberland Fusiliers. Who were these men? Where were they from? Were they all miners? Or was that a
no, not, not at
stereotype?
all. Not at all. And this is when people are reading about the Tyneside Irish, they maybe get a bit confused. The Tyneside Irish were four battalions, so they were an entire brigade within the Northumberland Fusiliers. They became the 103rd Brigade. And the
Yeah.
sorts of things that I've jotted down a few notes of some of the things that they were doing. So you had people from, you know, County Durham, you had people from Northumberland, you had people even from Castleford, you had people from Manchester, Mossley, those sort of areas. So it went far, far afield. It went far beyond that. East Yorkshire, what is now East Yorkshire as well. And the sorts of jobs that they were doing. I mean, you have people who'd been clerks, people who'd been in the workhouse, people who'd been miners, a lot of miners. A lot of miners do end
Yeah.
up joining.
Why then would someone from Manchester want to join the Tyneside Irish?
The recruiting goes much further afield after 1916, after, you know, what happens on the first day of the
Right.
Battle of the Somme. In 1914, soldiers from the Northwest, or individuals from the Northwest, are desperate to get into the British Army,
Yeah.
and they'll see that the Tyneside Irish are recruiting. And there's a big Irish community in the Northwest
Yeah.
around Cleethomore, so
Yeah.
they see that connection.
They say the Irish connection, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah.
And
You
what's
automatically think
really,
about them all being Geordies, don't you? Or I always have. And so we're
yeah,
breaking them up here,
sometimes they
aren't
get
we?
referred to as the Newcastle Irish, and they're really not. And it might be as low as 20% of people are actually from the Northumberland area
So would
in the
they then
Tyneside.
be, they wouldn't be a Powell's battalion then, really, would they, necessarily?
They're much
Obviously,
wider.
there's
They
groups of
are
men that would have
pals, but
served. Groups of men that would have been mates that served together, wouldn't they, I suppose? Some of them.
yes, they would be, but it's not quite as strong as, say, you know, the Barnsley pals or the
No.
Accrington pals.
Smaller
But
communities.
yeah, but the community, there's a lot of Irish Catholics who end up joining, but you get a lot of Protestants as well who end up joining. Really, it just becomes a loose connection, that Irish connection. So some
Right.
people who join never ever have any Irish connection whatsoever.
So the man then that helped finance it was reading your booklet you've produced, is Joseph Cowan. Who was Joseph Cowan and how did he contribute to it all?
Well, Joseph Cowan came from the Cowan family, who'd made their money in bricks. So a brick industrialist. There was in the family a radical liberal MP who had hosted Garibaldi in the 1850s. So quite a radical family. But in 1914, he uses some of his estate, Joseph Cowan. Rather confusingly, successive generations are called Joseph Cowan, so it's often difficult to work out which Joseph Cowan is being
Yeah.
discussed. He gives £10,000 at the beginning of 1914, at the beginning of the war. The War Office is not funding the creation of a lot of these new battalions until they officially
Yeah.
become battalions under the control of the War Office. So you need benefactors to help with the cost of this. He gives £10,000, and which is somewhere in the equivalent of £1 million nowadays.
Wow.
And what's interesting is that contribution is still recognised if you go to Lavoisier. you've got the Tyneside seat.
Yeah.
And if you go to the back of it actually mentions Joseph Cowan.
Oh, really? So his
Yes.
contribution was never forgotten then, was it?
No, absolutely not.
What happened? So they raised the battalions. You said there was four of them, and then where did they go for their training? Did they train locally?
Initially, they do train locally in and around Newcastle. Then it's obvious once the 4th Battalion is raised that they need to go elsewhere. So they go to Alnwick. The first recruits that they had was Sergeant Patrick Butler, and he helps to go and set up the camp at Alnwick. And they go from there, from Alnwick to Salisbury Plain. And it's January 1916 before they end up in France. We often like to think of the First World War as soldiers being sent straight into the battle. They have a full year of training in
Training,
these various camps.
yeah.
Yeah.
So
I mean, you have to.
when did they head out to France then in the end?
It was early January 1916.
Not till 1916, not 1950, 1916, sorry, yeah.
1916. They end up having to go into quiet sectors of the front. So they go to the Bois Grenier sector and they train with the 24th Brigade at a time. They're taken under the wing of various battalions of the 24th Brigade, and they're just led through the various aspects of trench life and trench routine until they become accustomed to it. As soon, but by the time it gets to May, they're already moving over to Albert. They're in the area where they're going to attack on the first day of the Battle of the Somme by May 1916, and by June, they're in line pretty much where they're going to attack. They'd been
So they
recycled
know what the
from them.
ground is like then. They know what the
So they
ground
know
is
what the ground is like.
like,
Yeah, so
haven't
they're familiar with it. And what's interesting is Captain and later Major Bibby, who's in the 27th Battalion, which is the 4th Tyneside Irish,
they?
is actually in a sector of the trench which is opposite where the Loch Na Garr crater is
Really?
about
You
to
know, he
be.
went over the top close to it, but he's actually in front of it for a while.
Right in front of it, yes.
Wow.
And other battalions in that brigade lead trench raids over that area. They want to know what that ground's
Yeah.
like so that they're digging in the right direction, that the mine's going to go off in the right direction, which is absolutely fascinating. They're not in there for the whole of May and
No.
June, but they certainly are aware of the ground of it.
Which makes it even more horrifying that on the day itself, so many of them were killed, coming over the ridge behind their front line. But I suppose they didn't think they'd be doing that, did they? They thought they'd be moving up through the communication trenches.
Yes, so the initial idea is that you move up through the communication trenches, and but there is a very, very famous one of the few authenticated pictures of the first day of the Battle of the Somme, where the Tyneside Irish are walking into battle, and it's just over that area of the Tara Usna line, walking towards the Loch Na Garr crater. And yes, they're walking. What you have to remember about this as well is that at this time, a lot of these fields are still, they're almost like meadowland, or they've still got crops in them. Now they're
Long
relatively
grass,
undisturbed.
isn't it? Long grass.
Yeah, there's long grass, so yeah, so
Yeah.
you can walk through it. It is fairly straightforward to do that.
But in that photograph, people think, oh, you know, they're in no man's land. They're not, are they? They're behind their own lines. They're just trying to
Yeah,
move up to their own front line.
and which is probably why a photographer feels safe enough to actually take that picture, because they're probably just under the brow of the hill, so they're not at that point under enemy fire, but they would be in a few minutes after that
Yeah,
point.
a few seconds probably, because they're very close to it, aren't they? And then, of course, they're
Yes, they are. Maybe a few
silhouetted.
seconds.
Yeah. So, I mean, we jumped ahead a bit there because I was going to say to you what happened to them on the 1st of July. So they've been there already 2 or 3 months. They've sussed out the ground. They know they've done trench raids. They've done lots of recce. They know what is against them. What actually happened then on the 1st of July to the 27th?
So the Tyneside Irish are part of the 34th Division, and the 34th Division, they straddle the Albert-Bapaume Road, and that is their major divisional target, their objective. They need to take that road. So you have a number of the Tyneside Scottish and Tyneside Irish who will attack just to the north of the road, try and take the Wysap crater, and that will be just one battalion of the Tyneside Irish that will help the Tyneside Scottish with that. And the other three battalions of the Tyneside Irish will attack around the Loch Na Garr area. So, but it's absolutely critical that they take those two points in order to take the village of La Boiselle so that the road will fall. The road's absolutely key. because that's the thing which, well, it's the thing which holds the entire Somme battlefield together.
Yeah, it dissects the whole battlefield, doesn't it?
Well, without taking that, the Somme, you know, cannot be considered a successor. And the objective is that this should be taken early in the morning, and so that by close of play of that day, they're on their way to Bapaume, if not already in Bapaume itself. So what actually ends up happening is that they do have a lot of success, especially south of the road around the Loch Nagar area. They do take the Loch Nagar crater. And in fact, some members of the 27th Battalion, along with other members of the Tyneside Irish, end up reaching Contalmaison, which is the third German line. You know, it's absolutely remarkable that they made it that far. We know that because reconnaissance from the air tells us that members of the Tyneside Irish were getting into Contalmaison as well.
And he actually says that in the battalion diary as well, which is written by our friend Bibby. He's actually written about himself and being in which we'll go on to talk about with the family. He's actually in Shelter Wood for two nights, although wounded, and you know, they're holding off German counterattacks that are coming from Contalmaison.
It's fantastic that they reached that far. But of course, if you reach that far and the brigades around you don't reach that
cut
far,
off,
well,
you're cut off.
Yeah, you're cut off. So the same happens with the 36 Ulsters in and around the Teak Val
similar situation,
area.
And that is famous. Everybody knows about the story, or people that are interested in the Somme, they know the story of the 36th Ulster Division. But they don't know, and I didn't really until I started studying this, how far this small number of men, relatively small number of men, actually got into the front line. And then you look at the what becomes a bulge or a salient, and they were cut off. You know, they would have been enfiladed from either side, wouldn't they? And it's a wonder any of them got back.
Yeah. What really is amazing about what they did is how far they got and how long they stayed out there as well, and they held off those German attacks. But there must have been a point where the officers and the NCOs who were in charge of these smaller isolated groups, where they realized they're going to have to return.
Yeah.
And, you know, so by the 3rd and 4th of July, returning back to their lines, they must have thought, you know, what was it all for?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Leaving their mates behind.
They will have seen so many people certainly wounded around them. What's very, very interesting about it is the divisional commander, Major General Ingleville Williams, actually wrote to the chairman of the Tyneside Committee, which had helped to raise the Tyneside Scottish and Tyneside Irish. And every time I read about Major General Ingleville Williams, or Inky Bill, as
he's
was called,
a famous character, isn't he?
I always get the impression of how sincere he was. He doesn't say words for the sake of pleasing somebody. No. And he actually calls the Tyneside Scottish and Tyneside Irish my gallant Tynesiders, he says. They covered itself in glory, and they behaved like veterans.
Wow.
So, you know, yeah, which is a real ringing endorsement to them.
But he didn't survive the battle, though, did he, of course, Inky Bill?
No, Inky Bill would die 3 weeks later. He would be killed in an artillery barrage when he went just a bit too far, quite close to Mamet's Wood, which is not far from
where... So he's leading from the front again. He's one of those leaders that were leading from the front rather than being in the Chateau Generals that we hear so much about. He was there at the front, wasn't he?
Yes, but he's one of around 200 generals in the First World War who were killed, wounded, taken prisoner. So he really does lead from the front. And I think it would be some consolation in 1916 if you heard that the Major General in command of your division was praising you in that sort of way.
In that manner. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it would have given, and they'd have needed a boost to their morale after what they encountered during those few days. And that message would have been passed down through the different ranks as well, wouldn't it, to all the men?
Definitely.
So do we know then, during on the 1st of July and the subsequent few days, how many casualties there actually were in the 27th or the 4th Tyneside Irish?
Well, overall, in the Tyneside Irish, we know that there's almost 600 killed and up to about 1,600 wounded. I say about, because we can't actually be entirely sure of the exact numbers. There's been a lot of research that's been done onto it, but, you know, casualties for the first day of the Battle of the Somme will always be estimates for a number of reasons.
Especially with the wounded.
The 27th Battalion, which is the 4th Tyneside Irish, has 149 dead and 390 wounded. So it's at 539 is what the official figure is.
Half their strength then, isn't it, at least?
Half their strength. And when you consider that, it was very rare on the first day of the Battle of the Somme for battalions to be going in entirely full strength, 1,007 is full strength, it means then that's possibly over half as well. It's hard to say as well, because we know that some people, you know, had been injured and then subsequently died later on. We have somebody from the 27th Battalion who in 1924 dies, and it's said that he dies from wounds from the first day of the Battle of the Somme. Oh, you know, he's never a casualty. He's not a casualty. You know, you have men from other parts of the Tyneside Irish who die months later having lost limbs. So it's very difficult. And not only that as well, you'll see when you go and if your listeners, they go and visit the various cemeteries of the Battle of the Somme, they'll see people dying 1st of July, 1st of July, 1st of July. But there'll be not many people that they see who die on the 2nd and the 3rd and the 4th of July. And frankly, when we say somebody died on the 1st of July, we're not always entirely sure because their body may not have been recovered for maybe a week later. And it could have been that they were injured on the first day of the Battle of the Somme, but they didn't die until days later.
Well, no one would know, would they? Because they'd been lying out in no man's land for several days, slowly losing consciousness.
The first day of the Battle of the Somme, we shouldn't think of it as a day. It's several days. But the Tyneside Irish as a whole, they lost one of their COs and two of the commanding officers, and two of the commanding officers are wounded. The Brigadier was also wounded from the Tyneside Irish. What's really critical to point out about the Tyneside Irish is their brigade has the second worst casualty figures for the first day of the Battle of the Somme. The first worst are from the Tyneside Scottish, which are in the same division.
So overall then, the 34th Division, am I right in thinking, has more casualties on that day than any other division on the Somme?
Far more than any other. And it's because they're where they're attacking the area in and around La Boiselle, there are three lines which can help with the defence, three German lines. And not only that, there are so many trenches which can offer enfilade fire. Yeah, so they can fire from the side. That is one which really, you know, critically affects them. So whilst they can relatively easily take the first line, you've still then got the second and the third line who are firing on, say, the area around the Loch Nagar crater.
And that's just within the first. We're talking about three lines of trenches that form the first major line of defence. But beyond that, then, another mile up at Poisier, you've then got the second line with another three lines of trenches within the second line. And then the third line, a few miles back, which hasn't yet been properly built. So we're not just talking about one trench and one line. We're talking about the first line of three trenches, then some more no man's land, if you like, and then another line full of dugouts and trenches. And it's not just one set of trenches, is it?
Absolutely. And the Germans had been in that area since late 1914, and they were accustomed to that ground. And those machine guns had been set up with interlocking arcs of fire as well. Yeah. So they would be able to know exactly as soon as soldiers come into one area of the battlefield, which machine guns, machine guns were deployed. So it's a very sort of by the First World War, the use of machine guns is very professionalized. They know exactly what they're doing in both the British and the German.
Absolutely horrific, isn't it? It really is. And of course, it does favour the defenders. So they came. So after that, then, obviously, they're taken out of the line. What happened to them then? Did they go back and rest and refit and get some reinforcements, or were they destroyed?
Yeah, there is a time where they need to be removed. So they're actually removed along with the Tyneside Scottish from the 34th Brigade, and they're put into the 37th Brigade, just purely because they're not a fighting force anymore.
They're spent.
After that point, the sort of the Tyneside Irish element, it's not as recognisable anymore. No. You have people from all over Britain who are being used to fill that those sort of places in it.
It loses its identity then to a certain extent. Finish off by talking about briefly the Pipes Are Calling. There's a couple of stories in the booklet you produced. One is The Pipes Are Calling and The Minstrel Boy. Tell us about that briefly.
So for a modern listener, the idea of taking pipes into battle might seem quite a strange idea. But when you're talking about, say, the Tyneside Irish, the music and the musical past of those groups it's absolutely key, and it's something which can inspire you. So on the first day of the Battle of the Somme, pipes are taken into battle by both the Tyneside Scottish and the Tyneside Irish. And Father McBrady, who was the brigade chaplain, went out into the battlefield later and found some Irish pipes that had been left on the battlefield. It turned out that they played the song The Minstrel Boys as the Tyneside Irish were going over the top. I'm not going to sing it, but I don't think you'd want that, but I do actually have an excerpt here of what the lyrics are of The Minstrel Boy. The Minstrel Boy to the war is gone. In the ranks of death, you'll find him. His father's sword he hath girded on, and his wild harp slung behind him. So that's the, you know, the minstrel boy.
Yeah.
And in the 1920s, he gifts the pipes to the Robinson family, who end up moving off to the United States.
Yeah.
And in 2001, the 27th Battalion, so that's Major Bibby's battalion,
yeah,
the colours are being rededicated in St. Mary's Cathedral, which is the Catholic cathedral in Newcastle.
Yeah.
And the Robinson family are invited over. The grandson of the person who had inherited the pipes played the minstrel
wow.
boy.
Wow, that you really know, is that overlapping history, isn't it?
It is,
in
yes.
So many different ways. That is fantastic.
But,
and they're still there, those pipes are still
yeah,
there.
But music is such an important part to the identity of the various PALS battalions. Another member of the 27th is Private John Scollin, who'd played the cornet in his local band. He wasn't from Northumberland. He was from Seaham in County Durham. Some of your listeners might know Seaham because of the Tommy statue sculpture, which is now in Seaham. He was in the battalion band as well, and he often played. And just before the Battle of the Somme, he thought he might die. So he actually ended up sending a letter back home, which is very famous. If you visited the Loch Nagar crater, the letter is actually on display on one of the boards around Loch Nagar. He just says in his letter to his wife, "Dear wife and children, it's with regret I write these last words of farewell to you. We're about to make a charge against these dastardly Germans. And if it is God's holy will that I shall fall, I've done my duty to my king and country, and hope justly in the sight of God. You've been a good wife and mother to look after my canny bairns." Canny bairns is what we say in the Northeast, you know, for the children, the bairns. "And I'm sure they will be a credit to both of us. My Joe, Jack, Tenor, Aggie, and not forgetting bonny little twins, Nora and Hugh. And my last flower, baby James. God bless them. So goodbye, goodbye, and think of me in your prayers."
And then what happened?
Unfortunately, he is killed on the first day of the battle. So,
and does he have a grave or is he on Teak Vale?
No, sorry, he's got no known grave. Sorry,
no, so he's
that
on
is in my notes. He's got no known grave. And that's what is really quite striking. When you think about the deaths on the first day of the Battle of the Somme, it's a total of around 19,000. Now, 12,000 of those have no known grave. So two-thirds of those who fought on the first day don't have a grave. Mm. And that is, I think, what is hardest, because we think, oh, they don't have a known grave. That must have been terrible for the family. But most of the people who have no known grave, their families do not get to hear that they've been killed in July 1916. They get told that they're missing.
Missing, yeah. And then, of course, they have that false hope, don't they?
They do have a false hope, and they don't know. And some of them, it's February 1917 before they're actually confirmed dead.
So and then they still won't accept it. That's what I've found. They still won't accept it. I've found stories in Northampton of families still waiting in 1919 when the soldiers are discharged, hoping they're going to come back from a POW camp or from a hospital having lost their memory. And that's natural reaction, isn't it? If you haven't got a body to grieve over, that's what you would think if it was your husband or your son or your brother or whoever it is.
Yeah, I mean, I often wonder with many of these battalions, even if they did have a known grave, how many of those families would have been able to afford to actually go and visit the grave?
No,
so
very few.
Having a grave would have provided at least some solace and at least some confirmation and closure. Yeah. It does, as I said, take over your life. It does become such an important part of it. But if people are interested in the Tyneside Irish, you mentioned the green booklets that we produced for the exhibition.
Yes.
We have secured a further couple of dozen of those. And if people are interested, these were produced with funding from a lottery grant and the Sir James Knott Trust. If people are interested in acquiring one of these small booklets, we can send them to your listeners. But Brilliant. What you have to do, if you're interested in that, you have to send an email to memories.tyneirishcs@gmail.com.
And I'll put, I'll put on the website, on Terry's Tours website, on the podcast page, I'll put a picture of the booklet and we'll put that link to the email address as well.
Yeah, they are limited, unfortunately, but we do actually have funds to be able to send them out to listeners if they're able to.
Super. Yeah, I've got one here and it's a great read. And some of these stories that you talked about are in the booklet, which I was amazed at, you know, the skull and letter and the pipes are calling the minstrel, but they're unbelievable. And that's what brings the battlefields to life. And you've done that superbly in this podcast. I'm really grateful, Martin.
Thing is, I'm a teacher. When this is taught in schools, it's always said, you know, 57,000 casualties on the first day of the Battle of the Somme.
The number, but isn't it?
The number doesn't mean very much.
No.
Until you start then looking at the individuals. And the project that the book commemorates is... it was to try and look at those people who survived as well. It's so easy to investigate those people who died because they leave behind more of a record than those people who survived.
Yeah,
but there are people who survived, you know, well into the 1950s and 1960s. Yeah. And we wanted to tell their story as well.
Yeah, of course. It's so important.
So a massive thank you to Martin for taking the time to come on the podcast and telling us about the background of the 27th Battalion of the Northumberland Fusiliers. So in this final section of this week's podcast, we've got an interview with Joe Francis and his two young boys that were with me on this trip to the Somme. And this is Bibby's descendants. Joe Francis, the dad, as I said, and his eldest son, Kian, who's just 11. Or by the time this podcast goes out, he'll be actually 12. And his younger brother, Ollie. And they wanted to explain what it meant to them to follow in their footsteps of Captain James Bibby and to actually walk the battlefield and find artifacts on the battlefield where their great-great-grandfather fought and was in the front line for 2 days and two nights and where he was actually wounded. So it's over to them.
What are we going to talk about then? So we've talked about James Bibby, who was how was he related to you again? Great-great-granddad, was it?
Your great-great-grandfather, my great-grandfather.
Right. And before you went to the Somme, this is probably a question for Joe, what did you know about him? Did you know anything at all?
Well, not very much at all, actually. It wasn't until my cousin Ben commissioned your good self to put together this little research document on Major James Bibby that I had really much of an idea of what he did. I mean, my mum grew up with him.
Right.
Being in her life, and she spoke a little bit about him, but we just didn't really know what he'd been through, or
because he died before you were born, presumably.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
in the 60s, wasn't he? Died in the 60s, I think, from memory. Yeah. And what did you say he was like?
Charismatic, you know, an interesting guy. We didn't really speak that much about him, and it's only really now that we've had commissioned you to do the report and we've been on the trip that I started to speak to my mum about it. Fascinating to find out a bit more about him and his character and certainly
what happened to him.
The journey that he had was just unbelievable, really.
And did you know much about the Battle of the Somme at all, considering that he was such an integral part of it?
Well, I mean, considering the trip that we went on, did you know much about it?
I knew that they're supposed to blow up the German barbed wire, but they just put high explosives on it and just blew it up and it landed. And they got quite a big shock when they went there and all the men were gunned down. So they thought they needed more and there are just so many waves of men just coming in and getting shot down.
But did you know that your relative was one of those men that was there leading the way? Did you know that?
I didn't really know he existed.
Mm. No, you wouldn't do, would you? Because it's so far back in time.
Yeah, that's it. And it's one of those we haven't really kind of thought to talk much about him until now. So, having been on the trip, having Ben done got the research done, it's just triggered a whole wave of interest.
Yeah, and emotions. So we started off on the first day we went to Ypres. You with your cousin, you laid the wreath at the Menin Gate. How did that feel, Joe? What kind of an experience was that?
Yeah, it was special, actually, really special. And I think you asked previously what was a memorable experience on the trip. That was definitely one of the highlights. Yeah, quite moving, very special. And Ben, having been in the military as well, Ben and Andrew obviously walked up and laid the wreath.
And then the next day we went down, made the journey from Ypres down to the Somme. And we started off, the idea was that we were going to walk in the footsteps of the 27th Battalion of the Northumberland Fusiliers, the Tyneside Irish. And they started their journey on the 1st of July, just a little bit to the north of Loch na Garr Crater. So we decided to start our walk from Loch na Garr Crater. So, boys, what did you think when you walked up that little hill up on the lip of the crater and you saw that great big hole in the ground? What were your thoughts?
Well, when you said that we were going to see a huge shell hole, I thought it would be about the size of an average room, because most of the ones I see around, they're quite small. But I never thought it would be something like that.
What about you, Ollie? What did you think?
I thought the same, because I saw lots of shell holes entering. They're really small, and when I walked up the hill and then I saw the massive one, then I was quite shocked.
And then, of course, it realised that explosion had been made from beneath the ground rather than the shells coming down. And the other shell holes that you'd seen were shells coming in from above. The Loch na Garr mine had been blown from underground.
Yeah, and I never knew that it would be caused by only two explosives, was it?
Yeah, there was two explosive devices that they put underneath, and together they amounted to something like £60,000 worth of explosives. So they were massive, and it overcharged, which is why then you walked up, because you've walked onto the lip and then you've looked down. So they've been overcharged to establish that lip around the side of it, which, of course, was supposed to work in our favour, but it didn't, because you remember what happened?
Was there a call that was intercepted? They rushed all the Germans out, and then they're just... there were a few still in there, and there were just limbs all around, and they had to bury them.
And then they came up out of their dugout, set their machines up on that lip, and then mowed the Northumberland Fusiliers down as they came across the ridge in the distance. So we left there.
It's amazing to think that anyone within any sort of close range of that crater would have survived, really.
It's a wonder anyone got past it. Or a little bit, you know, to the right as you look at the map, depending on which way you're coming from, but to the right as the British were attacking. There you've got, you know, as he was then, Captain James Bibby and his men from the Tyneside Irish. They're about 200 metres away from the crater. So they must have seen that go up. They'd have seen the spoil come down. They'd have seen all the mayhem in front of them.
Melt it as well, I would imagine.
That they would have done. The ground would have vibrated, wouldn't it? And on either side of them, the attack has failed. But your relative, James Bibby, he continues. And we walked up that road where they went over the top. There's a farm track. And on either side of us, the farm was the field had been ploughed recently. What did you find in that field, boys?
Just while Ollie gets that, actually, what was fascinating is... standing on the edge of the crater and looking across the fields, because of the time of year that we were there, it's obviously all the soil, great big heavy bag, all the soil in the fields, and then because of the chalk that had been dug out from the trenches, you could still see the marks and the chalk. And you had Terry, was it line?
The linesman, yeah, showed us where the trenches were.
Yeah, it just connects you so closely with the past to see those lines through
the field.
It's
ghostly. I think it's ghostly, because you can only see them at certain times of the year, because, of course, the crops are in the field throughout the summer.
We were fortunate with the timing, actually, yeah.
And it was exactly on those chalk marks in that field that we walked up by the side of, and that's when you found some of the exhibits that you're going to produce now. Ollie's got some there, hasn't he?
This is shrapnel. It was from a shell.
It's just a scraggly, rusty piece of metal that we found. We thought, wow, there is evidence that we've been looking for.
This is exactly on the location that your ancestor has walked across that field on the 1st of July.
Yeah, amazing. And to think, you know, the fields must be absolutely littered with.
He found
stuff.
A bit of shrapnel to start with, but I think
that was just a kind of a rusty, kind of, you know, fairly nondescript piece of metal, which we were fascinated by. Wow, we found. And then a little way up, right on where the German lines, where you could see this chalk mark through the field.
Yep.
Ollie's stumbled across.
I found a German piece of barbed wire.
Okay, right, Ollie. So we're looking at this barbed wire. There's two types of wire. There's the British wire and there's German wire. Can you remember how we know this is German wire?
It's quite thick, and also it was right on the German front line.
It was, wasn't it? We could tell from our linesman device that we were on the German front line. As you said, the wire is twice as thick, really, as the British wire, and the barbs are much closer together. They are horrific, aren't they? Even now, you could get that caught on your clothing and you wouldn't be able to go anywhere. What else have you got there?
That was a fascinating find, wasn't it? And then, as everyone was gathered round looking at this piece of wire, suddenly a few eyes lit up, and the boys are now presenting.
Oh my words! What you're holding there is hopefully a piece of you've got two of them, a shell case, but without the shell being inside.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, Ollie's is certainly empty.
Ah, right. Yeah,
it's full of.
And it's got the earth inside, doesn't it?
Earth from the Somme.
And can you remember, this is called the Iron Harvest. So many of these shells, about 1.5 million of these shells, were fired by the British at the Germans in the week before the Battle of the Somme. And they reckon at least 30% of them didn't go off, and they're still there. But as we said at the time, if they were unfired shells, they'd have the fuse on the top and they'd still be full of explosives and we wouldn't be touching them. But what you've got there is fired shell casing, so it's safe for you to pick it up and bring it home.
Yeah, I remember seeing on the side of the Somme all those the shells painted orange, but I didn't really think it was that safe to just leave them by the side of a road.
No. And why did you think it was? Why did we say that the farmers had painted them orange?
Because that's a sign that that they haven't gone off yet, and that they could possibly still...
They were still dangerous and live, weren't they? And they were going to become collected by the authorities.
Mm.
Yeah. And they're part of the 30% at least that were fired, and they were duds. You know, they didn't go off, but they're still dangerous. Have you got anything else there?
So I found a piece of German glass. That would be, the German would keep maybe some soup or something in it.
Yeah.
That was on the German trenches too.
Yeah, we had that checked out by someone, didn't we? You confirmed that it was a piece of German bottle.
We stayed at...
A B&B.
Number 56.
Number 56 with Julian David Thompson, that people will know.
B&B.
Yeah.
Over in the Somme. And very kindly, David gave you a fuse. One of the old fuses for the shells, which is a fascinating piece of engineering, isn't it?
And that's what David had found at some stage around number 56.
Well, he's got a wealth of various fascinating finds, hasn't he? What with the
What you're doing now, what Ollie's doing now, is just he's placed the fuse on top of the shell case so you can see exactly how it works. I think it just about fits, doesn't it? By looking at that,
it does.
Yeah,
it does. I mean, fascinating to find out as well about how they worked.
How it worked.
Having seen these things, we would have thought they'd just be fired and then they'd hit the ground and explode. But
and it evolved. It evolved as the war went on. They got more and more accurate. And they were using, in the end, they were using these fuses that as soon as it touched something would explode rather than it being above them. So it was much more sensitive and much more accurate, but therefore much more dangerous as well.
Of course. Yeah, I mean, I just never knew that actually the shell would explode above ground, about sort of 20 feet or so above.
Yeah, that's right. And then rain down the shells, that the shrapnel would rain down, shrapnel balls. What else you got? What's that?
It's like it was a bit of a mystery what it was when it was found. At first we thought it could be some kind of spring from a piece of artillery.
It's a coil, isn't it? It's a piece of metal that's in a coil.
It looked a bit like the barbed wire.
Yeah, it does, but it isn't, is it?
No, it looks like too tightly coiled, but it certainly looks as if it's got around about 100 years worth of rust.
Did we find out what it was then from David? Did anybody know?
I don't think you can say for sure, but...
still a mystery, isn't it? In that case, we'll definitely put a photo of that on the website, and I guarantee that there's people who know exactly what that is.
Yeah, wow, that'd be fascinating.
Yeah, it's part of a mechanism of something, isn't it?
Oh, well, and if we're in the process of solving mysteries...
Right, come on then, is this the big one?
This is not the big one.
Right.
Well, we don't know exactly what it is, but someone out there probably would know what it is. So Ollie's got a piece of...
We think this is a piece of bucket.
Yeah.
And it's got there.
Yeah.
And it hasn't gone over there. So,
oh, right.
We think that's a piece of bucket.
Piece of metal, isn't it? With a lip on, with a lip that goes in opposite directions on each end. So...
Mm. I've not seen anything like that before.
Again, someone may well be able to... Yeah. Do you want to solve the mystery in this?
Yes, let's solve the mystery. I better set the background to this then, because
a drum roll.
This has got completely out of control. This situation, no fault of my own.
No fault of your own. I'm completely innocent. It really was.
What happened was
So on the return journey, coming back to Lochnagar Crater, we did a big loop on the walk, and we found some amazing finds. Well, I suppose we should touch on what we found in Shelter Wood as well, because there were some interesting things up there. But having all the finds that we found, we hadn't found a bullet that had been fired. And we were saying, oh, it'd be great, be fascinating to find one, particularly with how many millions and millions there must be lying around. So on that little return journey back to Lochnagar Crater, saw in the soil this, well, should I I'd say this bullet.
This is a Lee Enfield bullet, a British Lee Enfield bullet.
There was a piece of flint involved in this presentation as well. And what happened is when I got back to the car, I showed this to you, Terry. I said, look what I found.
Yeah.
Obviously you took a photo of it and posted it on Twitter.
On Twitter, yeah.
By the next morning, what happened? You came down.
When I woke up in the morning and I put the phone on, it had lit up, and there was, I think, 56,000 views and about 800 likes on Twitter, which I've never seen anything quite like that. I mean, I haven't got many followers. And what had happened was people had retweeted it, and anyway, by the time we'd finished breakfast, it was up to 70,000. At the last count, 412,000 people had seen this image, which I said this bullet was fired 100 years ago and it collided with this piece of flint, and it's been there ever since. And lots of people came on who know about these things and said, can't possibly have happened, otherwise the bullet would have disintegrated upon impact. Mm. Little did I know, of course, that at this stage, when I posted it, I genuinely didn't know that the two objects were actually found a few yards apart. Is that right?
That's exactly right. I saw the bullet in the ground, lying on its own, just as a bullet. Picked it up, absolutely fascinated, and we found a bullet! Found a bullet, amazing! And then, probably about 20 yards later, I saw a piece of flint lying on the ground with a little indentation, which looked just about the right size and shape as the bullet. Being the sort of creative type, I thought, oh, that'd be nice. That could be a great way to present the bullet. So I picked the piece of flint up, offered the bullet into it, and sure enough, I mean, it couldn't be much more of a perfect
fit. It just fit. And my argument would be, although this isn't what I thought it was, that the bullet and the piece of flint was just 20 yards apart, and 100 years ago, they could have been a lot closer and even together. And the two boys, please tell the listeners, boys, that I didn't know that your dad had put these two objects together when I posted it on Twitter. Please get me out of this.
Did he know? Don't be so mean. No, he's whining out. It's very unfair. No, well, it was because Ben was there at the time, and he said, "Oh no, don't tell Terry, don't tell Terry." And I said, "Well," and I came out and said it. And your look, Terry, is the look on your face, because I didn't realise that you thought that they that
no, I know, no, I just assumed, didn't I?
And your face did drop when you thought, "Oh my God, oh no!" But I've just posted this on. What are people going to think?
And as I was looking at my phone, the numbers were going up by like 5,000 every minute.
It became a bit of a running joke. And
yes.
Focus of amusement for the rest of the trip.
We unintentionally misled 400,000 people, including many prominent historians in the World War One battlefield community. And I'd like to use this opportunity to apologise profusely for everybody and say that this is a mistake in very good faith. And I hope that people will still continue to come on my tours and listen to the podcasts.
Terry, I don't think there's any apology necessary, because you did nothing wrong at all. I'd like to think it's been a good promotional tool for your tour.
It certainly did, because all of a sudden the podcast had another 400 listeners or followers, whatever they call it, so it had an impact there. So okay, moving on then.
But can I just say, rightly so, that you deserve all those extra listeners and attention, because what the information and the research and everything you brought to our trip was absolutely incredible. So just a little plug for you there, Terry.
Appreciate that. Because we really brought it home then, didn't we? People will remember from my introduction that the 27th Battalion, and in particular Captain Bibby's company, got further ahead than anybody else did in that part of the battlefield on the 1st of July 1916. And they got as far as Shelter Wood. Shelter Wood then became a defensive position for them as the Germans counterattacked from Contlemason, the village of Contlemason. And for two days and two nights, your relative held off the Germans before they had to retreat. and he was wounded, wasn't he? James Bibby was wounded, but in Shelterwood, we just went down the side of Shelterwood. And what did we find in at the very point where they were holding off the Germans?
Well, we found a clip of bullets. There are four bullets all together.
So they're still in their clip, weren't they? In their original clip.
Yeah, they're all together. It had a lot of rust on them. Yeah,
so we can see that bullet, we know that's not been fired. How do we know that this bullet has not been fired, boys?
Well, and it's still, the actual bullet is still inside the casing.
It's still inside the cartridge. And they were all in a row, weren't they? I think there was a clip of five. One was missing. It's probably fallen out. And the other four were still in the clip, weren't they? And it wasn't just the fact that you found it. It's the fact that you found it on the very spot where your relative was holding off the Germans with his unit. Then they've withdrawn in haste, because the Germans are getting around them. The chances are that either James Bibby or one of his men has dropped that clip of Lee Enfield bullets in their haste to get back to their own lines all those years ago, 106 years ago. And then it stayed there until you guys come along. It was Ben that found it, your cousin, finds it on the very spot. You know, it's history repeating itself, really.
It's amazing, just amazing how close those two moments are linked, you know, the course of over 100 years. Mm. And to think that, you know, they'd literally lain there untouched, undiscovered until we came back 106 years later.
And this was the first time, as far as we know, that anyone from your family had been there. And I don't think James Bibby ever went back, did he? There's no record of him going back. Then we walked back up to Loch Na Garr Crater. We passed Gordon Dump Cemetery. I think there's 15 soldiers in Gordon Dump Cemetery that were killed on the 1st of July and on the 2nd of July. That were with James Bibby. So we saw their graves, but from a distance. Back up to the crater. We had beautiful weather, didn't we? Go round at the three then. What was your, starting with you, Ollie, what was your favourite experience of the trip?
Probably going to the Battle of Somme and seeing and finding everything that we found about 100 years old.
Wonderful. Yeah. What about you, young man?
Well, I'm the same, really, because I liked it's either going to the Somme and finding all the things lying on the ground. And also actually seeing the pictures of what it was like 100 years ago.
Yeah.
And all the kind of, all the mud and everywhere and all. And then actually being there where those photos were taken was quite cool as well.
Yeah, because you were standing on the very spot. And of course, there's that famous image of the Northumberland Fusiliers as they came across the crest of the hill and silhouetted against the horizon. And so many of them were cut down. What about you, Joe? What was your favourite memory?
Well, it's tricky, isn't it? Because of the nature of what happened, and it's I don't know, it just brings up a lot of emotions.
Emotions, yeah.
There's some sort of exciting highlights. Like, wow, look at this, what we found, and the sights we see and the landscape and finding out about the war. It's really, you know, it is really fascinating. But at the same time, it carries with it this very sort of deep and somber feeling of just finding out about what happened and what people went through. And yeah, really just sort of unimaginably horrific. So I guess in terms of highlight, I think doing that walk up around Shelter, retracing up my great-grandfather's, these boys' great-great-grandfather's footsteps was remarkable. That was a really, really amazing experience.
I think the other thing that I wanted to say, it's incredible because all three of you have said the same thing about the highlights. We did all the touristy things and things that everybody does, but we did that walk where your great and great-great-grandfather walked on that day, and it took me to a part of the battlefield that I've never been to before. I haven't walked across those fields like we did and along those tracks and round Shelter Wood. And it really, it teaches me, despite the fact I've been back to the Somme, I don't know, hundreds of times over the years, every time I go with a different family, different experience, I learn different things. And it's, someone says that the last page of World War One, it will never, ever be turned. And you'll never know if how much you know about it, because there's always new stuff to find out. And this was a great example. And the other thing that was amazing about James Bibby and the 27th Battalion is that we were following in the footsteps using the battalion diary, and it was him that had actually written the battalion diary. So, you know, we knew we were following in his footsteps because he'd written it.
Yeah, well, it was fascinating that to obviously hear your experience of taking people around, and that made it all the more special to realise how unusual it is that being an officer and having survived and obviously written these accounts, that to have such a sort of has a close connection to it all. It's just, but really just wanted to thank you for the incredible experience that we had and how special you made it, really, because without you there, we wouldn't have...
You wouldn't know where to go, do you? No,
hardly anything.
And that's how I was when I first went there, when I first went to my great uncle's grave in 2001. I didn't know where I was or what I was doing. You know, I made up my mind then that I wanted to find out about him and help other people as well. And that experience, that learning experience that I've had over the last 20 odd years, it's been fantastic. And it continues. This is the thing. Every day is a school day. Every day is a learning day. You never stop learning. And we proved it on that trip, didn't we? Right. I'm off for a curry.
Excellent. Well, enjoy that, Terry.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
Been great. Right. And really have a good weekend, boys.
Excellent. For sure. Great stuff.
Take care, everyone.
Thank you very much. All the best. Bye. See you soon. Cheers.
Bye.
So once again, thank you very much for tuning in to this podcast with me, Terry Wenham, podcast that I call Tales from the Battlefields. There'll be another one along in a week, 10 days, something like that. Not sure what about yet. Haven't thought about it yet, but I will. As usual, we're going to play the last post to see us out. And on this occasion, I wanted to remember all of those men from the 34th Division that gave their lives in and around Les Boisselles and on the other side of the main road on that 1st of July 1916. I'd like to remember not just the men that died, but also the men that were wounded and their lives were changed forever.